Good evening, everybody. We have another evening of Buddhism for the modern mind. And like the modern mind, we have probably the same amount of people online as in the room.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe more online than.
You got online video chat or something?
No, not video chat, just audio.
Nice.
Yeah, so we have more people. So, what we're going to start with is probably just some quick introductions to get a sense of who's here. And then we're going to jump into tonight's topic, which is still going to be on what is real freedom.
Can I pass the internet line to some friend? Is it too late?
Next time. Okay, I'll go over real quick the kind of spirit of what we're doing here is that we're hoping people would first come for a real class before we actually like send out stuff to, I don't know, so it's not actually a broadcast to the wide world. It's actually broadcast to a people who've kind of been around a little bit. Yes, experience a little bit of the monastery, so they have a little bit of sense of what's going on. So little bit by little bit, we're hoping that people will join in. So I was thinking that people could just say their name, where they're from. I don't know if there's anything. What else could people say? Maybe it's just what?
Quick introduction.
Yeah, quick introduction. Maybe say a little bit about what brought you here real quick. Okay, so my name is Jing Xuan. I am currently located at Berkeley. And what brought me here? I don't know what brought me to this world. All I have to say is probably a lot of confusion. I got here from a lot of confusion. Hopefully I can get out of it. So, yeah, okay.
Amitofo, everyone. My name is Jin He. I'm here because I'm living in a monastery and I can't escape.
Hi, my name is Jason Sang. I currently live in Berkeley, and I have to thank Jing Chuan for asking such a Zen or Chuan riddle for his intro. Why am I here? I don't know. I think, I like wisdom, and I find that
I like wisdom.
Buddhism has a treasure trove that I'm still kind of mining, and it seems like it's an ongoing process. So that's probably one reason why I'm here.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Kian, and louder.
Yeah, you speak loudly. Well, you probably just probably hears you. Just speak. Speak
okay. Up. Not really living anywhere, but living everywhere. So, I was telling a guest at this year at home this weekend. I'm a nomad junior, just like Doug. I don't live anywhere. So, and what am I here? I guess there's nothing else to do on a Monday night. What? Okay, your turn.
My name is Jamil. I'm originally from Charlotte, North Carolina. I live in Berkeley. I'm great I'm glad to be here, and I'm here definitely because I have an extreme desire for my cultivation and development in my spiritual life.
Oh. Hey, great. So now we go around and introduce everyone who's online.
Okay.
So let me see. There's based on who logs in first. JT from.
That's Jason.
Jason? Oh, just Jason? Okay, all right. Yeah. Carrie Taylor from Calgary, Canada has logged in.
Oh, good.
Tom Brochel, Millbrae, California.
Okay.
Steve Lin, Sunnyvale. Chow Kong Meng from KL, Malaysia. Okay, that's my hometown.
Right.
Yi Huan from Auckland. Guo Rong. From,
she used to carpool with me up there.
Okay, Guo Rong from Palo Alto. Tao from Riverside. Cynthia, which is Jin Hershel's mom from Saratoga. We have some people from CDTB. We don't know exactly who, but it just says it's CDTB. We have Liz Wong all the way from New York. On the East Coast. Spike is also joining us from CDTB.
Ellen Axelrod.
Oh, okay.
And Mark Bowen. I don't know where he's from, but he's here.
Danville.
No, but that's Mark Bowen. Mark Bowen's from Danville.
Danville. Jing Kaisher from CDTB. Marin from also CDTB is also with us. Let me see
from
if anyone
Avatar
else.
Avatar Translation Room. Oh,
and just in Brittany from Hayward.
Okay.
Yeah, I think for all the people online,
wow.
We only have 5 people in the room today. We're not sure what happened. Either they got scared off by dark, or they
probably... Actual presence scared them off?
Yeah, or maybe because they know that it's just these two young monks who will be here tonight, and we don't have a pulling power like dark. So just bear with us for a minute. We're going to have a smaller circle, and we would like everyone to move up.
Yeah.
Also, people are not used to every Monday.
Every
Monday? They're so used to every other Monday for class.
Yeah.
So it's a new schedule. Yeah, they're not used to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Better tighten up.
That's right.
But for
people okay, might come late.
Just for the people online, last week when Doug was here, we had 20 people.
20 people.
Yeah, a lot of them were listening slack jaw. They didn't quite understand what was going on sometimes.
Yeah.
So.
So make sure you type questions online then, because we'll go over what Doug is. It's online. So
online.
Make sure people who are just logged on, you'll see there's tabs at the top of the page. They actually work. One says listen. One says, reference texts.
This is better.
One says live notes.
Okay. Thank you.
And one says raise your hand.
You're the best.
So you type the raise your hand and you type in a question in, and we'll see it in probably about 30 seconds or so. I would say also for your for the text, we're going to go over the text. So if you go to the reference text, you'll see we're going to go over today. We actually want to have a appreciation for Lauren Bausch. She actually wrote up some of her notes for the class. So we're going to plan on going over that so people can kind of have a remembering what we talked about last week. And also for people who maybe weren't here, they can get a little bit of a sense of what Doug was talking about. And then we'd go over it. And a bit by bit to see what questions people had.
Yeah.
Actually, we probably can go over it. If people have questions along the way, we can just answer questions right along the way as we talk about it.
And this is something which we will not probably do in the future. But since there's so few of us, if you really feel strongly about something, you can call the Berkeley Monastery phone.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll do it like a talk show radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
you can get the phone over.
That's
a good idea.
Just for this time.
Just for this time.
Okay?
So the phone number, do the phone number load. 510-848-3440.
Repeat it.
510-848-3440.
Okay.
So we'll put you on conference call.
So we have some questions online, but we were thinking, just to make sure everyone's on the same page, if you can look to the text titled, What is Real Freedom?
Can I have?
Yeah.
And we'll read it. As we read it, then you can reference it on your screen.
Printer?
This is the key that opens the door.
If you don't have the screen, then I guess you just have to listen. All right. So, gender, culture, religion, economics, and other identities that previously limited people have opened up in the last 30 to 40 years, but it did not open up a liberation that people are confident in. Right now, there's the greatest amount of possible freedom, but this generation has done very little with it.
Okay, so I think the spirit of this one, what Doug was saying, is that he sees this generation of young people being the most potential freedom, because we're actually not limited by our cultural artifacts. We're not limited by religious ways of thinking. People actually have a feeling of kind of like a postmodern feeling of being able to understand a lot of things are not structures of thought they have to buy into. However, with that, I would say come a great deal of anxiety. And so when he says that people don't feel confident, I would say for myself, I definitely feel it's very, very... I was just going to explain the beginning piece a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So people accept context. So basically, the sense is that because people are not confident in that, then we have a kind of anxiety. And for myself, I can see that for sure. There's quite a bit of fear from that space. And so this is what he's talking about here, is that basically we have a lot of freedom in this generation with the modern young generation, but we don't have a sense of what to do with it. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll try reading all the text before we go into explanation so that everyone has a proper context about what's going on. So we'll continue. What does freedom feel like? a sense of infinite possibilities. And every time you act on one possibility, you collapse the infinite potential by tying up and limiting your conscious awareness with something. From spaciousness, conscious awareness can collapse onto an object of desire. Freedom is that conscious awareness that has not been limited to one focus. Freedom is a degree to which conscious awareness has that spaciousness. Mm. Freedom is conscious awareness unattached. So, okay, the key word is, the key line is, freedom is conscious awareness unattached. Determinisms are taught in college. Your conscious awareness is determined by culture, gender, biology, etc. No reinforcement is given to potential freedom, but only the limitations of freedom from the determinisms. Ideology and determinism take the place that conscious awareness could see freedom and pay attention, to watch the mind and see the emotions and thoughts that arise as a process with a causation within you, and lay over that social structures of interpretation.
So to give power to anything outside the conscious awareness, that is the determinisms, avoids responsibility and lets society control you. The moment of determinism is when truth is given to a theory, which avoids responsibility for every choice or action taken. Absolute freedom requires absolute responsibility. So you have given your conscious awareness to some other theory or structure, you have lost exactly that amount of freedom. Your karma is your responsibility. Any place that you do not take full responsibility, you cannot have freedom. To have a sense of your conscious awareness without these overlays is not easy. Compassion would be to want that complete freedom for everyone else. But today, people are needy and play off each other's needs and insecurities without expectations or loyalty. But to maintain this, it requires a great deal of work. Mm-hmm. One has to line up a lot of activities just to avoid being alone. So, freedom from sensory... freedom... so it's freedom versus sensory overload. Since it's, we'll explain it later.
To do dualities.
Okay, the problem is that people lack confidence in the conscious awareness that has freed itself. Modern fun consists of elevating the anxiety from the lack of confidence in one's own nature. Fun covers out the doubt, but it is based on fear. No one knows what to do with such great freedom in themselves. Is this freedom of conscious awareness something that you are able to enter and grow in? Are you comfortable, or do you look for distractions? Here is a marker. So it says, to try to see this in yourself, it says, are you comfortable or do you look for distractions? How comfortable are you in solitude? In your own conscious awareness in solitude for extended periods of time? Would you relate to people differently than a hypersense of relating based on lack? How do you experience yourself all the time? Does your conscious awareness have the space to settle and reflect? Modern people should develop comfort in solitude. This is where Doug turns it and he tries to give the answer. So modern people should develop comfort in solitude. Then we can care and listen to someone else without need and desire in pinging and causing projections onto the other person. Solitude is not being not social, but re-entering the social without projecting onto others and having someone share your projections.
There is only one reason for your lack of freedom. You. You have brought into a whole bunch of not so good stuff about why things are the way they are. The natural state is that human nature is good, whole, complete, and not missing anything. It's not sinful. The contented state of solitude is already there if you relax. You do not have to work on it. You have to put effort into your confusion. We are attached and invested in our own not-so-good stuff. Wherever you are attached to a story of yourself, you are limited by that. From identifying with the awareness of some story, we are limited. The story and investing in it limits you. You can watch your mind move. If you do not attach, your habit has one thought less power over the freedom of your mind. Every time the mind moves, you reinforce the habit. If you do not return to the mind ground, there is nothing you can rely on.
If anyone online has any questions, you can type it in right now.
But I think it'd be good just to go over each paragraph, because I think it's quite tight.
It's very dense.
In terms of actual material.
It's better the second time around on paper.
So I think just to elaborate what I was mentioning for that first paragraph, the gender, culture, religion, and economics. So basically, I think people could understand that we're a lot freer in this generation because we don't have to do a lot of the things that were predetermined in, say, ancient society, like you're going to be a farmer or you'd be something. Those are all kind of predetermined roles that we'd be kind of stuck in, or we'd be in some reality that was the only reality that we knew. So now here we are, in a world where we've got 80, 90, 100 realities that we're presented with probably all the time, you know, from religion to various disciplines, careers.
Even food.
So we see all those things, and then we try to figure out, well, what identity is us? I think a lot of, for our young generation, we kind of figure out, well, who are we? What are we going to find? And I think there's a lot of fear because we often feel like maybe we can't find who we are. If I reflect on my own process, I would say there's a fear of, the fear comes from a feeling of not being able to find anything there. So there's actually a fear of the emptiness, I think. So that's what I think the first paragraph is talking about. I'm going to do a second paragraph.
Yeah, basically Doug tries to explain what freedom feels like. The real freedom that Doug is pointing to is a reality for some people, such as patriarchs or someone who has opened up their wisdom beyond what we know as our mind that we used to think. For everyone else, it seems really abstract, although it is someone else's reality. And the only way we can point to what real freedom is to use examples that we can reference in our own lives, but which only gives us a really limited sense. Doug likes to use the example of, say, if you wake up in the middle of the night, say at 2 a.m., and when you wake up, it's totally quiet, you're just lying in bed, and your mind does not need to think about anything, and you are really comfortable. There's a sense of well-being, just being where you are. You don't have to get up. You don't have to go back to sleep. You don't have an urge to do anything, to check your phone, or to see what time it is, but you're just really, really well being in that space. Another way to reference that kind of feeling, what might work for some people like myself is, say, if you ever been on a vacation, for me it works at the beach. You're just lying by the beach, you have the whole day, you don't have to move. If you want a drink, you just raise your hand, the waiter brings it for you. You have everything you need right there, just lying down in the sun. And so that's another way to reference that. For people who have meditated, after a while, if you sit long enough, you come to a point where you don't need to move, you don't have any compelling reason to adjust your body position or to fix your mind anywhere, and you're just really cool, just abiding in that space with nothing, no stress on your conscious awareness. But that's all just approximations. It's still within what our conscious mind can think of. A person who has actually have real freedom, who has broken through his mundane consciousness, is someone who is always cool no matter what happens. So what does this mean? It could mean that you're walking on the street, someone hits you, and you're totally fine. You don't have to exercise patience because you don't go to a space that requires patience for you to cool down. Someone steals your wallet, and you're totally fine. It's the same as if you still had your wallet or you had not. So as I'm giving all these examples of people who are comfortable having, because they're abiding in real freedom, it seems really weird for us because we can only reference our own experiences in these situations. So we So just bear with me as I throw out more examples, a lot of which are actual examples in the sutras.
Yeah.
For example, we have Elder Master Si Yin, who was beaten for all intent and purposes to death twice when he was 100 years old, and he was totally fine. His mind did not move. We had the example of the Buddha in his previous life, who was known as the patient immortal because the king of Kali cut off all his limbs, and yet the Buddha did not give rise to a single thought of anger. So another way to rephrase real freedom is that your inner being, your inner sense of well-being is like solid steel, and you are totally not vulnerable at all. To that your sense of well-being is not dependent on anything at all in the world, and you are totally invulnerable to anything that can happen to you. So no matter what your conditions surrounding you are always cool because you have seen through all conditioned things. Yes.
Sorry to jump in. I think there's a question that's kind of related to that.
Okay. Question? Okay.
Maybe like 2 or 3 minutes ago.
Okay. Go for it.
Let's read out loud.
Yeah, read out loud. You
can see it too. So I think there was a question referencing the passage earlier. So freedom is conscious awareness unattached. Can we replace this freedom, for example, with liberation or enlightenment? Is it basically pretty much the same thing?
Yep. Once I guess you can say is enlightenment or liberation from our discriminations, from a world of duality. Yeah. I have another story about how trapped we are in and why we are not experiencing true freedom and why it is so elusive. Because we live in a world of discrimination and duality, we place a lot of emphasis on things that we seem to be really important to us. Two stories that come to mind was actually it's the same story. Rama Master had a fellow monk, which he I think saw a right time to teach, but it seems like he played a very funny trick on this monk. One day he told the monk, "Your karma is like the sea." And this monk got really, really angry. He said, "How can you say that? How can you say my karma is like the sea? Who gives you the authority to say that?" And Rama Master told him, "Oh, I haven't finished. I said, your good karma is like the sea." So for people listening, it's just words. But it's how we perceive the words that affect us. But it's just words. And then I think to the same monk, the Rama Master was writing something, and he was asking, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm writing a bill of sale. I'm selling you to someone else." And the monk got really afflicted. He said, "How can you sell me? You know, you don't own me. How can you sell me?" And he got really afflicted. So in reality, nothing's going on. It's just some words that were exchanged. Words. But to the monk, he took it really seriously because maybe his sense of ego, his sense of self. So that's what I mean when our mind creates a lot of realities based on our discriminations that bring us away from true freedom. And we don't see it because to us, that we are the sum of our thoughts, basically. That's what most people are. Yeah.
Okay. So people get a sense of that. I think maybe just to add a couple of thoughts to that discussion, and people are welcome to chime in. My feeling is that actually it's interesting, I'll say for most people, actually, waking up real late at night is like the emotional existential crisis moment for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. When they wake up in the middle of the night and it's all quiet, then they have this emotional angst going, "What am I doing with my life?" and so that's actually, it's interesting. So, I mean, I think that reinforces the sense that people have a sense of not feeling of a well-being when they're by themselves. It's actually a feeling of a fear that, you know, what am I really doing? So I just want to make that reflection. But I think to add another element to that, when we were talking about that freedom, is since I would say Doug talked about freedom in that kind of empty space, that kind of emptiness, that at least for me, I don't immediately relate to that emptiness so well. My sense is that I guess I go through a kind of actual interaction with that emptiness. And what I see from the great masters is that from that emptiness, they're actually able to teach and transform a lot of people. They help out a lot of people. It's not just like they're in this empty space and just lying on the beach and just hanging out on themselves and being really cool. They're actually out full-time, working hard all the time to help other people. I think it depends on the causes and conditions of the living beings, but at least we have the example of Master Hua. And for sure, the stories I hear is that, you know, he was working day and night to get living beings out of their confusion. So anyway, so that's my sense, is that the freedom that is attained through this process actually enables us to truly help. Otherwise, we're just going through our own narrative, our own projections. It's a freedom that's completely free to actually help people. So the next paragraph talks about determinisms. And I think this is actually a very useful insight, because this is something and they're all very deep, because we just grew up since, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, when we're really young, before we can even really cognize our thoughts into words and speak, we're already getting taught structures of thinking that determine our way of understanding things. So for instance, we grew up in America, one of the strongest determinisms is actually a scientific approach to the world. We kind of go through thinking that, you know, I am my body, in a sense that I, like for instance, I am the neurons firing in my brain, and that makes up me. You know, so if I can like control my way of thinking through my neurology, for instance, an example of that, although it's not a bad thing that we have this, but it's just an example. For instance, we have a lot of psychedelic
triggers.
We have drugs, for instance, when you get depressed or something, you take some drug that allows us to kind of get a balance of a neurology that allows us to be more level. So, you know, for sure that works, you know, on a level of something. But at the same time, in Buddhism, this says that we're actually not made up of our neurons. We actually did something a lot deeper. For sure that has an influence on us if we're just working from that place. But in terms of actually where we are coming from people, we actually have a freedom that's much deeper. And so I think for Buddhism to point that out allows us to feel like we can be, we can let go of the determinisms that we're in. So the other ones that I think for me that was really helpful was coming from growing up in America. I got a kind of a Western education, but in terms of being Asian, I grew up with a kind of Asian upbringing. So it's funny because I found that Buddhism allowed me to find a balance between the two cultures. Whereas if I would say, okay, real clear example is, for instance, relationship with parents. You know, for instance, in the West, young person growing up often has a sense of rebellion to your parents. We kind of grew up with a sense that I need my own person. I need to establish myself. My parents are kind of like, you know, they're doing their thing. So I'm going to do something different and be walking on this other path. And that's how I define myself. And that's a good thing in the West. In Asia, oftentimes it's follow your parents. You go be filial. Usually filiality is interpreted as complete obedience, almost kind of like listen to everything they say and follow what they say. And so you have these two structures of approach, which can often be, I would say, growing up in America, often there's a conflict internally because we don't know how to deal with that two structures that are in common. We have a lot of those structures working. What I think Buddhism is helpful is because it looks at those as, oh, they're actually empty. But then there's principles that it's given to look into those questions about what to do, how to deal with our lives.
What principles?
Okay, so for instance, the principles of virtue. Like for instance, in this one, like for instance, I just mentioned the idea of parents, right? I would say for me, where I found the middle is that there's a teaching of filiality in Buddhism, which is basically that we're supposed to respect and care for our parents. That's really important. That's a really seen as a really great blessing that we could do that. But it doesn't say, you know, obey your parents blindly.
Mm.
Just whatever they say, you follow. Even the Buddha himself is a very clear example of somebody who his father wanted him to be a king, and he went off and became a monk. He's embodying something that says what your parents tell you is still limited with a determinism. It's within a construct that's trapping you with your conscious awareness. With your conscious awareness, it's trapping you.
So care and respect them, but don't let them control your life.
Yeah, they don't control your life. You have to really care about them, be compassionate, and listen to them, and really put. And in many ways, you want to put their I would say their needs, but you care them, but actually more than you pay attention to yourself. I don't know how to say that in a way that makes sense. As an example,
accept them for who they are.
Accept them for who they are. But first, I'll give examples. Like another thing that I thought was really interesting is when you're interacting with your parents, it's like, at least for me, it was like, okay, putting my parents' concerns before I put my own concerns. So if they call me to do something, I immediately help them with what they need done, rather than doing what I'm doing. If that makes sense. First, they want. Okay, this is a gross example because obviously I'm not doing anything good. But as far as they call me for dinner time or lunch time, I actually go and respond immediately. Or they help with some chores or do something in the house. I would respond as quickly as I could, rather than before. It would be just like, okay, whenever I get to it, even my own mind creating a space where I'm just doing my own thing and my parents are just nagging me. And I think that's, I get this all the time from Asian parents. I don't know about Western parents, but Asian parents at least. Pretty sure Western parents are the same thing, is that their kids don't want to talk to them at all. They don't want to say anything because their parents are nagging them all the time in their mind. What I'm saying is that the way to get out of that is actually to listen to your parents and respond to their concerns as quickly as possible. And you'll find that there's a space where by being respectful and caring, you can support them. But at the same time, you're not obeying them blindly. You still know what you're trying to do in your life. So there's a very delicate balance there. And that requires, to maintain that space requires cultivation, because you need a practice to maintain some level of, I would say, virtue and patience in our minds, in our conscious awareness, to allow us to apply principle to that. Yeah.
So how about your parents' respect for you? If you ask your parents to do something and how they respond, say they don't respond the way you want them to.
That's exactly what we were talking about projection. So the most ideal is what we're cultivating is we drop all our projections. So therefore, I don't have any expectations of my parents.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the ideal. Now, of course, there's going to be something that happens. Of course, we're going to have projections. But in terms of the ideal that we're moving towards, so there's actually a real interesting example in...
So let go of your expectations.
And also the process of cultivation allows you to see how you treat your parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way, have you been contributing to any, say if your parents treat you in a way that you don't like, has cultivation gives you that space in your mind to observe your thoughts and your own actions, and then to look at yourself to say, have I done anything to contribute to this? So,
contribute to the way they treat you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is it actually my fault? Because usually the ego doesn't allow the mind to go there. The ego just says, how come you're not good to me? How come you're not nice to me? I'm your son, or I'm your daughter. You're my parents. You should be like this to me. But it very often we don't see how sometimes we might have a role in that.
How do you see that?
Through cultivation.
Practice.
And there's a lot more than that. Maybe we can
just taking time to see yourself in the relationship that you're in.
Yeah.
Through a combination of mindfulness, awareness. At this point, I'm not sure if this is the right time. I just want to explain a bit about the emptiness. There's a misconception regarding
what
emptiness.
Paragraph is that?
It's not actually here, but it was what Jin Chuan Shu just mentioned when we had the second paragraph.
Okay.
There's a lot of misconception about emptiness being like a void, or like nothing exists.
You mean the emptiness when people wake up in the middle of the night?
Not really.
Not that one?
The emptiness of
your thoughts?
Not being attached, and then everything becomes empty.
And meaningless.
They equate emptiness to meaningless. But in Buddhism, emptiness is actually equated to wonderful existence. And what that means is,
one of the stories that popped to mind was when the Buddha first became enlightened, and he was walking down this road, and a person saw him and was so taken by the Buddha's countenance that he went up to the Buddha and said, "Are you a god?" Buddha said, "No." Say, "Are you a..." He asked a serious question. That, do you remember?
Yeah.
Yes. Are you a god?
Are you an avatar?
Are you an avatar? Are you... Because he saw that the Buddha was so calm and peaceful. And the Buddha said, just kept on saying no. He said, "Are you chakra?" He said, "No." "Are you a deva?" He said, "No." Then in the end, the man just said, "So what are you?" Mm-hmm. And the Buddha answered, "I'm awake."
"I'm awake."
Yeah, "I'm awake." That means I'm no longer sleeping. I'm right. No longer dreaming. Because in our dreams, we are confused. Yeah. So basically, being awake, when you wake up from your dream, no matter what dream it is, you realize how confused you were. You were taken in by your dreams. So that's a way of seeing what wonderful existence is. You wake up, and instead of being empty, you see things for what they are. Your mind can be rational again. So that's one way of seeing what actually wonderful existence is. And Chin Choshu was saying that it enables people then, when they have true awareness, it's not sitting by the beach and when they teach. It's because when your wisdom really unfolds, true compassion arises. Because you see the people around you who are still dreaming, who are really suffering, and your compassion naturally comes up and you just want to help them.
Okay. Go to the next paragraph. What do you want me to do? Okay. So the next section talks about giving power to anything outside of the conscious awareness. So we actually talked about a little bit already about how determinisms control us.
Giving power to the...
Giving power to other things. For instance, our parents. Maybe we were just this, you just mentioned how, well, what about if your parents don't respect you? Actually, the moment we place that expectation out there, we're giving up some of our freedom. If we don't take responsibility ultimately for everything that happens to us, then we're saying that something else is controlling us.
So the more you dwell on it, the less freedom you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything you identify with, say that what makes you you. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a man. I'm a strong man. The moment that gets challenged, you get afflicted. You know, the moment someone hits you and that person is stronger than you, if you identify yourself as a strong macho man, the moment that impression of you gets threatened, then you get afflicted. And then you withdraw from freedom.
So affliction is lack of freedom.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and you can see that very
easily. You can see it in politics. Someone who identifies himself as a Democrat will probably get his emotions up when he's surrounded by liberals, for example.
It's the other way around.
Other way around? Okay.
Republicans are
the liberals. Right. Or in sports. Or in sports, if you identify yourself with a team, yeah, in some countries you can get beat up for being in the wrong place.
But I think the concept of actually coming at this from complete responsibility is really interesting because... Mm-hmm. It puts the responsibility in a completely different place than what most of the time in society we're given. So I remember Doug mentioning during the talk last week about how the reason we get into all these determinisms is because we're trying to be the victim. Mm-hmm. And that gives us gives up our responsibility. And therefore now we can just be the victim. So a lot of people, we put ourselves in the role of a victim, and that gives up our feeling of needing to do anything. And a sense of responsibility. And that's maybe a useful coping mechanism, but in terms of ultimately getting free, is not very helpful. And so in Buddhism, it's actually kind of tough because you actually have to go look at our lives completely and say, okay, so how have I caused my life? So what he's saying with his parents is, what have I done with my parents that have caused this relationship to occur the way it is? Maybe there's very extreme cases, and so for me, it's very extreme cases of parents being very abusive. You know, okay, fine. That's maybe it'd be better if you're completely separated. But most of the time, with most parents, there has been a lot of interaction. And then when you start cultivating, it's really interesting to look at it because you can start untying those knots bit by bit to see where those things connect. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is all Cedric or not, but my thought was to say, in a different way, like, is affliction of your relationship with what you eat, like, is that lack of freedom? So y'all get afflicted from what I eat. Say for I'm not a vegan or vegetarian,
yeah,
and I eat meat and whatnot, and I'm afflicted. It causes disease. Is that lack of freedom?
You're saying that what you eat causes you to get sick,
right?
Because you're eating meat,
right?
If it causes anything that causes you affliction, it's a move away from.
Okay.
Let me tell you this. I like to interject this. The idea of having to have eating meat already is already you are in the castration. You are already bound yourself. Mm-hmm. By that notion.
So I was born into a condition, but okay. I changed.
You just in your mind, say that you need to eat meat. You need to eat meat, or you want to eat meat. Of that desire, that is already being bound. You're bound by that. That's lack of freedom already.
Well, mine was just a question in general. Personally, yeah. I'm not a meat eater, so.
Well, yeah. If you for a. I can tell you this. I'm wondering, the word freedom, to me, I kind of taking it. I'm coming in here late, so I'm apologize. I missed the first part. But the word freedom, to me, it's have in the small meaning, and this can have a very big meaning the freedom. Its range is really big. On a small scale, I can relate it to it that, let's say, I was kind of addicted to sugar at one time.
Right.
I really had to have Coca-Cola every day. It's a normal thing.
Right.
And then I know that it drained my energy.
It's an affliction then, that's what you're saying.
Yeah, of course. It did become an affliction. Maybe at first it was out of endorsement, out of lack of knowledge. You enjoy it. And you keep doing it and then became like addicted to it, even sugar. So every day I had to have that during lunch, and breaking that away from it, it's just like a real effort.
Right. So exercise and disciplining yourself once you're aware of that affliction is a lead to freedom. Correct.
Yeah.
Not yet.
You
being
say.
Independent.
Not yet. Yeah. It is a beginning. It's the beginning of knowledge. And then it's still a decision whether or not you decided to want to free yourself from that addiction or not.
Take strength there.
Well, and then it goes through the deprogramming stage,
reconditioning,
which is you're gonna have to do an exercise to counteract that craving and lack of
exercise,
right?
Can you name an exercise? So, for instance, you were addicted to cigarettes, right?
Okay.
You want to put it down, but you have a craving you're dealing with. What's your exercise that you will replace with the craving of a cigarette?
Okay. Well,
running?
Number one is that you have to able to watch your mind and catch it at the moment that it is arising that you are craving. And number two is that put yourself out of. You have to be disciplined enough to put yourself out of that environment.
Huh.
Let's say that if after you eat a meal, your habit is after a meal and the cigarettes afterward is a real ideal, right? Mm. You do it all the time, constantly, that's what you do. Mm. So put yourself out of that mode.
So
don't have a cigarette after you eat, run or do something beside.
Right. So walking meditation plus action against a craving.
Well, you know, meditation is the key to a lot of these, to the answer, insightful of this, what subject that we are talking about.
Right.
Number one is that we all think that we have control of our mind, but we are fooling ourselves. The mind is really tricky, and it is very hard to tame.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really go through and do it abruptly. Because this is life after life result. So what we probably need to do is just like one step at a time, watch your mind and start practice meditations a little bit, and then you're gonna start to see it.
So, following up with this conversation, like say for instance you're aware of it, you have a craving, but then. You're denying yourself, and you know you're wrong, but you fall into that craving, do you beat yourself up after the fact?
No. Well, what good would that do?
Just a question.
What good would that do?
I think if you look at how the process works, actually probably would be better not to, depends on the person's personality, but to say if you're able to stop completely, that's great. But in terms of the actual process for a lot of these things, you have to kind of go step by step. And so your putting down of something, if you want to do it gradually, you kind of look and say, okay, I'm going to not do it this many times, less and less and less. You kind of build up something.
Some stability.
Yeah, but the sense of beating yourself up is actually kind of reinforcing your self-hatred. It's a kind of aversion, so it's not actually very healthy.
Right.
It's actually when three poisons we have is greed, hatred, and delusion.
It's a desire.
It's a different flip. And at the same time, also when your this thing occurs, I mean, there's a certain way it's denial, but actually, the way that is most helpful is actually just observing it. If it's like, okay, so this is coming up. You watch the sensation rise, you watch the sensation fall. That's a lot of the meditation. It's basically just watching what we're doing come up.
You will be able to trace it all back to a single thought in your mind that sparks a chain reaction of thoughts and body actions. Sometimes it could be, say, after a meal, like what Nam was saying. You feel something empty in your chest. So let's continue with the smoking thing.
It's a burning sensation.
Yeah, for discussion, so let's just continue with the smoking thing. Mm-hmm. It could be you want to take a deep breath. You feel the need to take a deep breath. But you equate that to a feeling that you want to smoke. Mm-hmm. And then your thoughts move. And before you know it, you're looking for a place that you can smoke. Mm-hmm. So meditation trains you to be more aware of your thought process.
Mindful.
To be mindful. So that the next time after a meal, you concentrate on your breathing and then you just look at your mind to see when does the impulse of smoking actually come from. So it's very individual for everyone. But you got to do it and try it out to see if it works.
So is this a exercise for that maybe? Just being the witnesser of that feeling without reacting to it, there's meditation too, right? Say, for instance, you take that, you have that sensation of wanting a cigarette, you try to watch it rise and fall, but without action, the more and more you practice that, the more and more freedom you gain from that.
Precisely.
But if you give in to it, what is that?
You're reinforcing it.
Your habit.
It's your habit. You're just reinforcing
the
habit.
Kind of like on the fence.
So it's a moment to moment practice.
Right.
So meditation is a moment-to-moment practice.
Everything we do and think and do, basically, if you think it deeply, is probably from habits.
Habit, right. Like you said, the sugar thing.
Everything is habits. Yeah. Everything that we reinforce, that we behave or we decide to do, is habit. And if you, those little by little, if all of those that we are being breaking away, that would be like freedom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a question online.
We have a question.
No. We have a question online from Tao, and her question is, what is the difference between lack of something versus freedom? For example, one determinism is eating meat, but if you break free of that determinism and not eat meat, aren't you just going into another determinism?
You answer? Okay. Well, I think that's a good question for inquisitive minds. I would say, actually, yes. If you get attached to not eating meat, you're going into another determinism. And I'll give a couple of gross examples and then some interesting stories. One is, let's say somebody's attached to not eating meat. Well, they could become like a vegetarian.
With a cause.
Vegetarian with a cause or vegetarian. Vegetarian police, exactly.
People love PETA, but anyway, yeah.
And go and like be militant about vegetarianism. So you can see that's actually going a little. That's actually making an entire identity out of it, and creating a whole bunch of stuff. That's kind of a gross example. I mean, this I wouldn't try it at home because I would say no, we're not at this state. But actually, some of the Buddhists, like the really greatly awakened masters, actually ate meat, which is like, whoa, ate meat in the Chinese tradition, which was, well, I would say, they did it actually, I would think, to be kind of exactly to this point, because they were showing non-attachment.
But these people, you could say they already had real freedom.
Yeah, they had real, I mean, so that's why I said it's really tricky, because in the West, what has happened is that these ideas have come in versus like, okay, I would say not drinking alcohol, but people like would take these stories and ideas, oh yeah, so therefore we have this crazy wisdom, we just eat meat, drink alcohol, and don't live, have a moral life, and that we're free. Actually, Buddha doesn't say that at all. Actually, these great masters, I mean, so this is a little bit of the world that not most of us are in, but these are like...
Okay, one example of this story, just to clear up any self-referencing misconceptions, is there was this monk who would eat a pigeon every day for lunch.
Right.
Every day for lunch, he would eat a pigeon, and then one day the cook said, I wonder what's up with eating all these pigeons. And after cooking one pigeon, the cook ate one of the pigeon legs himself before serving it to the monk. And then the monk questioned the cook, and the cook said, and the cook denied it, said, no, I didn't steal any of your pigeon. So what the monk did was he opened his mouth, and out from his mouth flew out a live pigeon with one leg missing. And the monk said, there you go. That's the proof that you took a leg from the pigeon. So these people who do all those things, you could say that their freedom comes from free from the karma that we would do, that would happen to us if we did the same thing. So don't go around saying that just because other monks or enlightened people have done it, so can I.
Well, so what I was going to posit about that was, this is kind of in a whole another spiritual realm. So from that story, you can tell there's a kind of a spiritual thing going on. For many people, it might be a foreign thing that people aren't used to. But that's what I said. That's what comes in all these stories, that there's this kind of other realm that's brought in, which is a spiritual realm. But I would say for most of us, we're not there. So in terms of being vegetarian, I think where we want to start is be vegetarian. Don't get attached to it and get identity out of it. You do it because you have a heart of compassion to help living beings.
Right.
You know, do it out of a sense of ideally you're not even doing it for your health. You're not trying to be vegetarian for your health. You're actually doing it because you want to. You see the suffering caused by vegetarianism. So even if it was better for your health to eat meat, you still wouldn't eat meat. I mean, I actually meet doctors who are Taoist who kind of say, "Oh, you should eat meat because it's healthier or something." But actually, in the Buddhist tradition, the idea is we're actually not eating the food so that we're going to be the healthiest. It's actually because we're not doing it out of compassion and understanding all living beings are our family. And so, we don't want to eat our family.
Yeah, so the kicker...
At the deepest level.
So the kicker is, as long as you take a position or your identity is formed from one position or the other, that's determinism.
Hmm.
And that takes you away from freedom.
Okay, so that's the next level. Next line is, compassion would be wanted complete freedom for everyone else. Would be to want complete freedom for everyone else. But today's people are needy and play off each other's needs and insecure without expectations or loyalty. Well, do people have that experience?
What?
Does that make sense? So basically, compassion is giving other people their space to develop without placing our own judgments and expectations on them, but at the same time, always being ready to help them all the time, to support them in their own process of cultivation. So that's what Dharma friends are in the most ideal. There's no stickiness. We often talk about not being sticky because the stickiness is where the emotional attachments come in, the projections come in, but the actual care and concern we have for one another on the spiritual path is always solid. So there's a sense of like, okay, somebody makes a mistake, well, maybe there's an appropriate time and we ask for their permission. Can I tell you something? Okay, so maybe this is a little bit better like that. Okay, so there's a kind of a process where you help each other on correcting one another's faults, because oftentimes we don't see our own problems so clearly. Somebody else sees it way clearer than us. So that's the ideal for compassion. It's not a it's not a compassion that is just always like, you know, you love everybody in this kind of like
it's not hippie love.
New age way. It's actually more of a, it actually is born from this emptiness, this kind of prajna wisdom. And you see this freedom and you realize that this freedom is really whole and complete, and you want everybody to be able to
experience it,
abide in it, not have to be insecure and afraid of themselves. You know, so when they do wake up in the middle of the night, they don't have a moment of existential angst, but rather they're content and happy. You know,
it's hard to be compassionate towards people who are like so needy towards themselves.
Needy to themselves?
Yeah, like full of hate and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's what do you mean? It's hard to be compassionate to them?
Towards that, yeah.
Towards like, people
who are prejudiced and racist and, you know, don't allow you to even come close.
Difficult people.
Yeah, that's
you
know, tough.
People who don't acknowledge you.
Yeah.
Yep.
So how is it that you can carry compassion for
that's
that?
That's why it's called a practice. Yeah. It's not. It's,
I mean, I can understand practice. It, but
the fact that we see people in that way, that means that we are having our projections onto them. That means we put them in a particular category. So our mind creates areas that they fall in. So like you just said, the words that you use, like people who are hateful, people who are prejudiced, people who take advantage, those are labels that our mind creates for people with certain kinds of behavior. Just as we would create a label on someone who's really nice, we have a label for someone who's really compassionate.
Sometimes I see it as like absent-minded actions, and once the person realizes it, they'll be like, just like, oh, I'm sorry, you know? But you have to make it aware to them. So
we have all these labels on people. It could be good labels, it could be bad labels, but the labels come from our projections of how we think someone is based on their actions. You get what I mean?
Our labels come from our projections of how we feel people should be.
That's right. So, for example, there's someone told me this story. So you see two people running down the street, okay? One person chasing the other. The first person gets tackled, and the second person starts beating him up. Okay, what would you think? So my response.
What would I react?
Yeah, my friend.
How would I react?
My friend asked me, "What did I think?" I said, "Well, I would think that, you know, maybe I should call the police. The first person needs help because he's been beaten up. The second person is probably a crook. He's probably trying to." So my mind starts creating all these realities,
concerns.
All these possibilities,
mm-hmm.
concern, you know, or aversion or anger. And then he said, okay, what if I tell you now that the first person who's getting beat up and the second person are brothers? And the are brothers.
Right.
And the first person stole money from his mom, slapped his mom, and ran off.
Right.
So the second brother is just teaching him a lesson. So what would you do now? I said, well, then he deserves it. So do you see how then our mind starts creating ideas for ourselves based on what we see, and then we start labeling people based on our discriminations of them? And then if you understand that, then that's actually where the problem lies.
Understand what?
If you understand how the mind works, the mind, when we see someone, we automatically put them in certain categories. If you see someone in a suit and a briefcase and he's driving a Porsche, you probably think successful businessman, mm-hmm. right? If you see someone wearing a stethoscope, you say a doctor, because that's how a mind has been conditioned to think. It's driven by habitual tendencies, you know? So the moment our mind does that is the moment we move away from real freedom, because we start creating labels or determinisms, categories of people. And we start reacting to them based on the categories that we have in our minds.
How if I reacted like this? Whatever's going on between them two is their business. And all I can do is sit back and observe until
sure,
the
if you
right
can,
time.
If you can have that for everyone you meet. But the problem is we don't.
So for instance, we just mentioned the hateful person, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd have the same reaction.
What?
You'd have the same, that would be the same reaction, right? Which is observing.
Observe him until what point?
That he's not a hateful person. You just observe him. Just like your thoughts go up and down, So your thoughts of him as a hateful person comes up, you don't pay attention to it, it goes down. Uh-huh. So to you, he's not a hateful person.
Okay.
It's just your thoughts telling you it's a hateful
person. So just be kind of reserved or
just, I think
no, that... it's not reserved. It's just to understand that the moment our mind creates labels,
uh-huh,
that's a move away from what Doc was trying to say by real freedom. That's it.
Right.
Whether good or bad, that's not the point.
So the more we're able to let our thoughts go up and back down, the more freedom we have. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in a way you could say that. Yeah.
The more we let our thoughts control us.
Right. So don't respond to the first thought.
Understanding how our mind fools us.
Uh-huh.
What our mind tells us about what we see, what we hear.
That practice.
That's the first step. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It kind of really reminds me of one of the passages in the section 42. I think it says really, I mean, it always kind of struck me because I came from kind of like this college educated background. It's like, you know, to train your mind to be the sharpest kind of, I have to speak up a little bit. So, I mean, from the Sutra of the 42, and I think it says like, don't really fully trust your mind. You know, obviously you have to use your mind, but you can't really trust your mind fully and rely on that until, you know, you develop a certain level of understanding or a certain level of clarity. I know the technical explanation is as an arhat, you have to actually cultivate to that level.
Until a four stage arhat, you.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Does that go for thoughts and emotions?
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Don't trust either one.
Understand how they come about, I would say, rather than don't trust. If you understand how your thoughts arise,
where's coming from? What is the, what's the source of it?
Yeah.
Trigger.
And once you find the source,
then you know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
I think the
what? So once you find the source, is the way you make a decision based off which way to go now.
Yes, you find out why you make certain decisions in the past that were that way.
Well, what?
You find out why you would make certain decisions, and then you have the space to actually decide for yourself what you want to do next.
Mm-hmm.
So your freedom, in a sense, is being able to decide what you want to do rather than being dictated by past habits.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, we're talking about fate or kind of predestination, those kind of concepts, or free will. We come in the West a lot on those things. Predestination or fate comes from actually these determinisms and these labels. If we only operate within our labels and our own real kind of attached self, it's just a mechanism of habits moving down a path. It's actually quite predictable.
Mm-hmm.
So from going back to the place of conscious awareness, do we actually have freedom to actually choose a direction? Otherwise, we're just actually just going through the motions of some structure.
We're just acting out our thoughts without thinking about what is it we're actually doing.
Yeah, so that's
kind of like a robot.
Is there a
but
point where your
emotions.
Freedom actually becomes more creative than what you're used to?
Oh, for sure. I would say actually that's one of the main. I would say one of the first experiences for a lot of people when they actually say attend like an intensive meditation session is they have a lot more creativity.
For sure, yeah.
Because all of a sudden your mind is freed from a lot of the mm-hmm. baggage it's been carrying around a lot. People don't realize that.
Instead of following a staple or a guide, you're more or less creating your staple or your outcome.
Yeah, but the thing that's actually really important as well, not just to go, you don't go about that kind of haphazardly,
uh-huh.
is that Buddhism does give structures. Where you can use to... help you develop more freedom. Because what happens is, oftentimes we get this quote-unquote space to be creative, and we do something stupid with it. You know, and I can think of probably quite a few examples. You know, we think we're really free, and then we go off and, you know, either get into a relationship or
go against certain laws,
think I'm free from it. And you have to deal with all the things that come from that. Yeah, repercussions of that decision.
Uh-huh.
So Buddha says, okay, there's a lot of guidelines to this meditation that will allow you to get freer over your process rather than just saying I'm going to be completely free
and just get everything else.
Yeah.
All right. Haphazard is what you said.
Haphazard. Yeah. It's not a haphazard freedom.
Okay. Wild and crazy.
Yeah.
Wildebeest.
And that's what actually the monastic form exists. And I would say the whole precepts, the idea of precepts. And
the yeah. So the discipline. Whole system that the Buddha taught to achieve real freedom is not one based on a freedom of choice, but one that starts from precepts, which is a way of life, a guidelines to live your life, that leads to concentration or samadhi, which is what happens when you meditate, and then comes the wisdom, which leads to true freedom or real freedom. So it's not coming just only from meditation.
Yeah, and that's really important. We were just I said an article by our high school friend across the street about how meditation wasn't really that helpful for one's developing our kind of what do you call it, helping our relationships get better.
Yeah,
and the reason is because
somewhere in the article said I've been sitting here counting my breath for 40 years.
What?
And it hasn't done me any good.
He's lost his idea of meditation.
So wait, the first thought though, which is the, and it was interesting because actually wrote a response, you're probably going to respond back. But basically, because here in the West, people have taken meditation out of the context of the precept samadhi wisdom model. So they're just taking meditation just as it is. So all they're doing is sitting and just being kind of just sitting. But there's no structure to guide it. And so I think Jinghoji gave a real interesting example. He said, okay, so it's like saying, so meditation is actually very useful, but it's like saying you have aspirin, you take aspirin, but it's not fixing your broken bone.
So aspirin doesn't work.
So aspirin doesn't work. Let's give up the aspirin. It's not to give up. It's not that it doesn't work. It's that it's not being applied properly.
So just to give everyone context about the importance of precepts, wisdom, and then finally, precepts, samadhi, and then finally wisdom, is that in traditional Chan monasteries, for the first 5 years, a novice monk does not meditate. He is not allowed to meditate because for the first 5 years he has to study the precepts.
Okay.
So by studying the precepts for 5 years, not only his mind comes down to be ready for meditation, but his thoughts also become increasingly pure to prepare him for meditation. And that's for monks. So what about, you know, people living in this crazy world right now? You know, who meditate without understanding the whole system of precepts,
right.
Samadhi, and wisdom.
So that was my question, because it sounds like the precepts are very important, and I'm kind of new, so I'm sorry for asking, but where do you go about finding this information?
Okay, we'll talk to you. That's okay. A conversation for after this
I'm
class.
Sorry.
That's
good. Yeah. It's a good question, though. That's a good question that you're interested in. It's a good question. It's a good sign, I have to say.
Yeah.
You'll find that's probably one of the most important questions in your life.
You know, okay. If you're going to ride a bicycle, you might as well.
Learn how to ride.
You need a manual.
And you know what? Meditation, I read an article somewhere, some hospital in New York, they use meditation to cure the drug addicts and also cigarette addicts.
Uh-huh.
And it became very successful. I forgot which
hospital. Which New York hospital?
Yeah, but they use strictly only meditation.
So let's finish.
Change the psyche, right?
Yeah.
We'll see if we can quickly finish this article here.
Where are we at?
We're at the question of modern fun. This is actually something that Doug pointed out.
Problems.
Which people think about that. Is that true? People see that? But basically, what he was saying is modern fun people... Especially this young age now, the modern young people are basically, their fun consists of actually getting away from that anxiety, that lack of confidence in their conscious awareness.
So breaking the barrier.
No. It's basically distracting the mind from the conscious, the freedom that they could see that they may not see they have. That
from being alone with your own mind.
Being comfortable in solitude.
Yeah. So what Jin Chuan Shou was saying, most people in the middle of the night when they wake up and everything is quiet, they get anxious. They get freaked out because they're not used to
their own
just
solitude.
Listening to their own minds.
So their freedom conflicts with their, I mean, their fun conflicts with their freedom.
They're just not used to their mind. Mm. That's
so
why we
have
distraction. Yeah.
To distract yourself.
That's why
from
we have distractions. We have.
So they think they're bored, but they're actually not. Is that what you're saying?
Think they're bored. You know, they're afraid of being bored because
they're afraid of being bored.
Afraid of missing out.
Yeah, they're afraid of missing out.
They think there's something else going on other than what's here.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Actually, there's an interesting. I remember when I first started even interesting these kind of more religious, or not religious, but kind of questions of meaning. I know a lot of people interpret it as being depressed. Although I didn't wasn't depressed at all, but the there's an interesting feeling I think that people see looking into these questions outside the context of, say, Buddhism or just in the world. Most people actually see it leading down to a road of depression. They don't actually see...
But you're not having fun?
Repeat it?
I'll say that again. That basically...
If you're introspective...
If you're looking inward, I think actually out in society, a lot of people feel that there's no answer. And so when you just go inward, you're just going to get more and more depressed. It's kind of meaningless.
Society has given up is pretty much what you're saying.
I don't know if it could be generalized, but I'll say in terms of the people I could see around, when I started going to these kind of questions in a particular way, that's more introspective, people actually will equate that with depression. Because I think for a lot of us, there's that sense of actually a fear.
Feeling alone.
Of a fear of feeling alone. You could keep connected with stuff all the time. And so I mean, I think that's one of the greatest things I feel I've learned from the Dharma is actually having a sense of a contentment and happiness by being by myself. I don't need to have anything else with me. And that's how we are as people.
How about this perspective? Because for me, by myself, I have the most excitement, most joy. And is that a problem?
No.
Kind of like I've learned to.
You know, without going to your mind, it's really hard to say.
Well, I'm just saying that I've learned to, it's just almost like super creativity. I'm just making small things more entertaining than what they are.
I think the question here is. The
even
topic
that
is,
would be a distraction.
Yeah, what are you depending on for your sense of well-being? What are you depending on for your sense of well-being? The whole topic that Doug was trying to point at is, does your well-being depend on something external or internal? And if that's taken away, what happens? Okay. Do you get upset?
I don't think it's that.
So,
it's just that I think I know how to use it. I don't know.
Yeah. So, Jason, we have a question here. I'm not sure if this is from last week. It says, please elaborate more about why do we lack the imagination of transforming or using our freedom, and how does one nurture confidence in one's nature?
That was from last class. I'm not sure to address it, but
you can answer it.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I would say that related. The second one, how does one nurture confidence in one's nature? I would say really slowly. Through practice, through very, very small steps, because confidence is not something that comes overnight. It's something that has to grow within you. When you put the practice into practice and see the results for yourself. So the moment you see your thoughts arising and falling, and you have some success in overcoming a habit that you have, pick a small one. Something that usually causes you some kind of affliction, but you want to overcome. Have a lot of patience. Try to sit quietly for a while and see how your mind moves towards that. And don't beat yourself up, like what Jamil said. If you give in, use that energy or emotion, the negative emotion that you feel, not to beat yourself up, but turn it into something positive to say that, well, I didn't get it right, I'll do it better next time, and then look forward to the next time. So nurturing confidence in one's own nature, to be able to see your nature, you need to do it slowly. And like I said, the Buddha's teachings is very simple. It starts with precepts, holding the precepts, and then what comes next is concentration, and then what comes next is wisdom. But it's a long process.
I think when we talked with Doug this afternoon, he actually had some exercise maybe for this week people who are here could look at to kind of see, but basically look at your biggest affliction and see if you could trace it to its source.
Biggest affliction?
Yeah, what's the biggest affliction you have? I mean, maybe it's
anger,
jealousy.
How do you understand what your biggest affliction is?
What makes you unhappy?
What makes you unhappy the quickest?
What if you have more than one?
What makes you unhappy?
Yeah.
What if you have a lot?
No, just choose one.
Oh. Just choose one.
What's the homework or whatnot?
Just to pick
afflictions.
Pick an affliction.
Hold on, I got here.
Pick an affliction. You could say the greatest affliction you have. If you have so many, you can't figure out which is the greatest.
They're all equal.
Just pick one of those and trace it back. See if you can try how far you can trace it back in your mind.
What's the trace mean?
Like, where does it come from?
So
what happens? What do you do before that affliction really takes over your mind?
So,
say for someone who likes to smoke, right? When does the craving come? Is it after food? So if it's after
food. What about this one?
Yeah.
Not having the success you feel is yours.
Happy affliction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now how do you trace that?
Where do those feelings come from?
When do you have it?
Excuse me?
Watch when it comes up. For example, let's say, you know, sometimes...
In regular life, it comes up.
Every day. I feel it right now.
Every moment.
I'm sorry.
So when it comes up...
trace where it comes from.
Yeah.
Actually, one method, I mean, if you want to try, is of course when you're sitting, you can actually see yourself. If you actually plan a thought, you can actually see it blossom into a full out doubt or a full out worry. You actually can see. So you say, okay, for me, a lot of my problems are around doubt so you actually can see. I have this thought. Maybe it's not really like that. Maybe I should be doing. Maybe I try this other
method. I know what you're talking about. So you say place a thought and watch what?
Watch where it goes. It goes off into confusion real quick. Mm-hmm. So don't do this all the time, because generally what we're trying to do is not do this.
What?
But you just see it happen. You go, oh, wow. And so when you see it clearly when we're meditating, because we're actually watching our mind. But what happens is when we're just walking around in our day, these thoughts are actually happening all the time. So it just launches our mind in this direction.
So you can replay the situation that caused you that unhappiness in your mind and see what happened.
And
so what's the purpose of placing the thought and watching where it goes?
You see what you're doing to yourself.
You see what you're doing to yourself.
Yeah. But in the end, what that points to is how important it is to always be watching your mind.
Purpose.
Because we're always doing that. We're having thoughts all the time.
Okay.
And most of the time we're not watching it. And we miss it, it can go off to a full-blown affliction before we even know what happened to us. We could be angry and have road rage. I guess there really was an example. Doug said last time somebody was texting somebody, somebody shot somebody.
That's a real thing.
Somebody went out and shot somebody.
The point is that the importance of this is to see what you're always doing to yourself.
Yeah.
But the affliction is something that takes over you. Takes
well, I know that, but you have to be aware of your practice or your conditioning, right?
Yeah, you become aware of your conditioning.
Good point.
So I would say there's a couple ways to look at it too. I mean, one other way to look at it is your body. I find the body has a way of not lying to us, where our mind often can trick us. It's basically, oftentimes, for instance, anger has a feeling in the body of heat.
Oh, what? What? One more time? You said it has a feeling of heat? Anger?
Anger.
So anger. That rises in you, what? That's what you equate that with?
You can catch yourself getting angry. Or
you feel your body sometimes.
Your body will tell you.
What if that's not... What if you say... What if it just... It naturally just pops there?
Oh, it doesn't... That doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen?
Anger doesn't just appear out of nowhere.
So, for instance... If I notice that, hey, I'm getting hot, and I'm like, I don't know where it's coming from, you just say, that's maybe because of some deep down inside.
What I'm saying is
you go find certain things. Yeah, okay. You find certain things. Everybody has a different thing. So, for instance, I'm just trying to say, place your emotions. If you want to watch a causal process, you can also watch it in the body. So, for instance, what else? fear.
I think that's not a one-on-one relationship.
Yeah, it's not a one-on-one relationship.
Inference works sort of one way, but not the other way.
Yeah. Doesn't mean if you're hot, you're angry.
No.
that's not how it works.
Like just
it,
like energy, right? like.
But I mean, but another example is if you're overly calm, and if you're, let's say you're breathing. The breathing is another method. If you're breathing very deeply, I would say it's pretty much impossible to get angry. You can't go into a full-out rage.
Right.
If you're breathing very deeply.
Okay.
And very calmly.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that the body is actually very connected with our mind.
I thought the first thing that gets hot is your head when you're angry.
Yeah, so if that's what happens to you?
Not
you,
me, but
other people.
That's what I would think, man. Like, you see people get red in the face, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
The blood rush to them.
So don't look outside. Look at what inside. Look at our side. So find whatever we like, what is our
I'm not playing. Ask too many questions.
I'm sorry.
Is that ask too many questions? Okay.
Yeah, so that'll say that's what I would go about it. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, so actually that covered the next part, which was talking about freedom of conscious awareness and what the markers were. And then we talked a little bit about solitude. An idea of not impinging on other people with our projections. And this is really important with our relationships. Is to give other people that space.
Give people what? A space?
A space to exist in their own space.
Yeah, accepting their actions or who they are for whatever purpose, I guess.
And then the confidence that ultimately we're complete, whole, not missing anything, not sinful underneath. So if we could just return to that state of solitude and happiness, everything would be okay. We just relax, nothing to work on. And actually, we have to feed our confusion.
You have to feed it. Why?
Because we're telling a story all the time. We have to work really hard at thinking up all this confusion.
So you feed your confusion to practice.
No.
You're feeding
you have a narrative of yourself all the time. It takes a lot of work to have that narrative going. Mm-hmm.
That's confusing what you just said to me.
I think the point is, it's not an instruction. It's not saying, oh, you should feed your confusion. It's saying, for us to be confused actually requires effort, whereas to not be confused is actually...
All you need to do is not think, basically. Mm. Yeah.
That's how you feed it.
No. That's how you not feed it. Don't think. Something happens to you, you don't think at all. Right. You know, you see someone, originally my mind would go, this guy's either, like you say, hateful or something. But instead of that, you don't think.
Same as like, say somebody says something and then you don't think, but you feel
think.
Something.
Don't feel. No, don't think, don't feel. Okay. You're just totally cool. Yeah.
So that's freedom.
That's the beginning of freedom.
That's the beginning of freedom.
Yeah.
You're able to do...
Feelings lead to reactions too.
Yeah. So you want to wrap up?
Yeah, that's it.
So to wrap up, true freedom means that your sense of well-being is not dependent on conditioned things, which is basically the whole world around you. And through cultivation, you can achieve true freedom, which is like a solid... You're really steady in yourself, so no matter what happens to you, your happiness is not dependent on external conditions.
So next week we'll have the next topic, I think, is on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
What?
A little bit of pun there.
Is it the same thing we just talked about tonight? It's
close. So probably Doug will probably develop it more.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah. Right.
What's the liberty part?
Well, we'll find out.
Find out next
Come
week.
Come back next
we'll
week.
Find
and
out
we'll
what,
know.
How Doug
All right, everyone.
Hold on. Do we want to still end with the parting verses, or should we want?
Okay, if you have it.
Do people have it? It's on the bottom.
Okay.
Of the last.
Okay. Yeah. Pass that out.
Last week.
Doug wanted to read
material.
This at the end of the. You have more copies here. The last second page.
Is everyone reading it together? Or?
Yeah, but he does remember we read it together.
Parting verses.
The parting verses. So this is the sixth patriarch. If you want an example of what a free mind, read the sixth patriarch. He really.
Sixth patriarch? What's that?
He'll tell you. Okay. He'll tell you later. Let's read it first. Too. Let's conclude the class.
He'll tell you after class too. Too much information.
Okay. All right, ready? Firm and steady, not cultivating good. Light and happy, doing no evil.
Calm and clear, no dusty sights and sounds. Vast, the unbound, liberated mind.
Okay, everyone online, thanks for joining us. Amito Four, and because it's night in California, good night.
All right.
Good night. Okay.